From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. President Trump is vowing to win a fight that has seemed unwinnable, the war in Afghanistan. The president outlined a new strategy for America's longest war last night.
We will not talk about numbers of troops or our plans for further military activities. Conditions on the ground, not arbitrary timetables, will guide our strategy from now on.
The president did say that this is not a blank check for Afghanistan, and he will put more pressure on Pakistan to stop giving the Taliban safe haven in that country. Let's get some reaction from Jason Dempsey. He's a former Army officer who fought in Afghanistan. He's now a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security, and he joins us from Washington. So Jason, welcome, first of all. And did you hear a strategy for victory from the president last night?
I did not. I heard the terms winning and victory quite a bit, but I did not hear quite how we're going to get there. It appeared to be a continuation of the status quo.
I mean, when the president says that he's not going to let arbitrary timetables guide our strategy, it's hard to read his mind, of course, but as commander in chief, is he saying that basically this is going to be an open-ended commitment now?
Absolutely. You know, a lot of people have argued that the timeline, if you say timeline, then Taliban just waits us out. But what they miss is the other half of the argument about why we have a timeline. We have an articulated timeline specifically because that is the most direct incentive to get the Afghans to carry the fight and be self-sustaining. If you're an Afghan right now and you just heard about an open-ended commitment to total victory and you heard about how the power of the U.S. military is going to be unleashed in perpetuity, what incentive do you have to step forward and take the fight yourself?
Now, to this question of total victory, I mean, you fought in Afghanistan. What would or should total victory look like? And is that even possible?
Total victory is absolutely not possible. And that's what's distressing about the speech. And I think where we need a commander in chief and where the president absolutely cannot abdicate the role, because he is absolutely the only one that can say, this is what's achievable and this is what I'm willing to give up to achieve it. That's strategy. Not just declaring that you want to win, but declaring how you're going to win. And in an imperfect world, what are you going to give up to win? And so right now, we're still on this idea that we are going to have kind of a democratic, fully functioning government in Kabul that's able to stand on its own. And while he did kind of allude, or he mentioned, well, you know, we're not going to tell them how to live, he really didn't say, well, what are we willing to let go when he mentioned this principled realism?
Well, you know, the president did mention some specifics, though. I mean, his comments about Pakistan and putting more pressure on Pakistan, I think a lot of people found very interesting. Was he right to say that? And how would he do that?
It's interesting, and I'm no Pakistan expert, but what I would say is we rely on them quite a bit. And the reason we haven't cracked down on Pakistan before, you know, there's several reasons. One, they're a nuclear power. Two, they're constantly on edge with India, and it's a very multi-layered strategy with them. And most directly, as we saw about 6-7 years ago, when we do lay it on Pakistan, they just shut down our ground lines of communication. And that has very direct implications for how we fight the war. So it's really going to be interesting to see as they retaliate or as they react to this, how much it hinders our efforts in Afghanistan.
You know, it has been 16 years. This is the longest war the United States has been involved in ever. And, you know, in a couple of years, we'll be sending troops there who weren't even born when this conflict began. I just wonder, I know this might just sound like a completely unrealistic statement, but what does the United States have to lose if we were to withdraw altogether from Afghanistan? And, I mean, because you're painting a pretty pessimistic picture about what's actually possible there.
Yeah, I am. And unfortunately, there's no easy answer, because withdrawal also comes with consequences. But the question all of us have to ask is, well, is this terrorist sanctuary any more compelling or dangerous than all the other terrorist sanctuaries around the world? And to what end and how much cost are we going to put in to prevent this one hotspot versus all the others? And again, unfortunately, that's part of the question we haven't answered. And I would say one of the most depressing things about all this was when the president led with the sunk cost argument. And that's really depressing. When you start saying, well, soldiers died here before, therefore we need to double down to justify their sacrifice, that's not a path to a coherent outcome.
Jason Dempsey is a former Army officer who served in Afghanistan. He's now a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Well, tonight, President Trump makes his first visit as president to Phoenix, Arizona, as that city's Democratic mayor is asking him not to in light of the violence in Charlottesville. Here's Mayor Greg Stanton on CNN last night.
It's just not the right time, and it really is just to inflame people's passion and to put people at risk, and I don't think that's appropriate, and that's why I stepped forward and said this is not the right time for this type of a rally.
The mayor wrote in the Washington Post that Trump has doused racial tensions with gasoline with his muddled response to Charlottesville. The president has also hinted he's considering a pardon for former Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who was convicted of criminal contempt in July for ignoring court orders to stop his illegal racial profiling and his crackdown on illegal immigration. Jude Jaffe Block is a fellow with the think tank New America. She's in Phoenix. So, Jude, how will President Trump be received?
Well, I think Charlottesville has really changed the mood here in Phoenix about this event. There have been Trump rallies here numerous times before, but the city is really preparing for unrest in a way that's quite different. Businesses and schools around downtown and government offices are closing early in preparation. And so there's really a little bit of a mood here of anticipation that there could be some confrontations because tensions are so high after Charlottesville and the president's response to Charlottesville. Plus, adding to that, the hint that an Arpaio pardon might be on the table has really inflamed a lot of people's interest in protesting.
Well, and let's just underscore, some people are wondering why the president did not go to Charlottesville after a person was killed there, and instead this is more of a campaign rally. But you mentioned Arpaio. In 2011, the Justice Department said that he was the worst racial profiler in American history. Remind people of why there would be anger if, in fact, he was pardoned.
Yeah, so there has been Latino grassroots groups here who have been fighting Arpaio's immigration crackdown in Arizona for a decade, but they finally won in the courts. But later it came out that Arpaio had in fact disobeyed the judge's orders, had continued immigration patrols after he was supposed to stop, and he was just recently convicted of criminal contempt for that. A lot of people in the Latino and the immigrant community felt like there was finally some hint of justice to what they had felt was a very unjust system for a long time. They feel like a pardon would completely undermine the American legal system and their idea that everybody is equal before the law. On the other hand, Arpaio's supporters feel like he was unfairly victimized by the court system, that it was an Obama administration political vendetta that led him to be prosecuted for criminal contempt in the first place. And so they see a presidential pardon as restoring their faith in what they see as the justice system gone wrong.
And what he was accused, and what Arpaio was accused of doing, was keeping detainees in tents in the desert in, you know, over 100 degree temperature, and allowing his officers to stop anyone who was Latino or Hispanic without any reason, encouraging them to do that. But you mentioned Obama. Arpaio is also one of the biggest proponents still of the false birther lie about former President Obama's legitimacy as president. So people are waiting to see if President Trump will make that pardon tonight. But also, it could be a big night for Senator Jeff Flake, who's been so critical of Donald Trump. And we're reading today even of other Republicans urging the president, don't attack him because he may lose his seat. What's going on there?
Right. Well, there's been this longstanding feud between Flake and Trump. Flake didn't actually vote for President Trump. He's actually supported a lot of the president's initiatives in office, but he's been very vocal and critical. He's just written a book that's quite critical of the president. And Trump recently tweeted that Flake was weak and toxic, and he said he was glad to see Dr. Kelly Ward challenge him in the primary here in Arizona, which is coming up next year. And there's a lot of speculation that perhaps the president is going to formally endorse a primary challenger to try to get flake out of office, which is quite unusual. They're from the same party. And there's some questions about whether a primary challenger would win in a general, and could that seat become vulnerable if Flake loses his primary. So right. it is a very important race.
So you say the mood has shifted there in Phoenix, but has it really among the Trump supporters who helped put him in office overwhelmingly in that area?
There is a recent poll out showing that among Trump's base here in Arizona, he's still doing quite well. And I think the mood has shifted here just in the sense of anticipation of this rally. There's just a lot of tension in the air and a feeling that things could get potentially out of hand just because feelings and emotions are running so high right now.
Reporter Jude Jaffe Block in Phoenix. Jude, thank you.
Thank you.
A picture from Spain caught our eye. It was a group of older Muslim women in head coverings, publicly mourning those killed in the Barcelona attack. And reportedly, some of the terrorists behind that attack were their children. How does that happen? Well, we point you to a new book and to Sophocles' Antigone. Antigone and her sister Ismene can't save their two brothers. Both are killed in war. One, the soldier, is buried with honors. It's decreed that the other, the rebel, the embarrassment, must be left on the battlefield to rot. But Antigone defies that decree and buries him. Kamala Shamsi's devastating retelling of Antigone is titled Home Fire. At the center, two British-Pakistani sisters, Isma and Anika. Isma raised Anika and her twin brother Parvez in London after their parents, including a father they hardly knew, die. Isma goes off to study in the U.S. Anika studies law in London. Parvez becomes fodder for ISIS recruiters. Homefire has been longlisted for Britain's Man Booker Prize. Dwight Garner of The New York Times says it builds to one of the most memorable final scenes I've read in a novel this century. We agree, and we will not give that away. Author Kamala Shamsi was born in Pakistan, became a British citizen, and like her character, studied in the U.S. She joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
What were you trying to say about this nexus, Pakistan, London, a U.S. university?
It's not so much I'm trying to say as I'm trying to explore and understand. Mm. You know, and these are places which have interrelated histories within my life very personally, but also in the last few years, I suppose, within sort of a post 9/11 world, there have just been different ways in which all three countries have been caught up with the war on terror and have different ideas about it. And if you're someone who moves between the three, you get very struck by the way people see the world differently and experience being in the world differently. And I was also interested in what it is to be a Muslim in Britain, which is my new country. I mean, I became a citizen there 4 years ago. I've been living there 10 years. So in a way, I think this was me exploring this new nation that I'm now a part of.
Yeah, and I'm looking at you. You're wearing a beautiful dress. Your arms exposed. You're not wearing a head covering. Mm-hmm. Isma, your character, this older, sober sister who's raised her siblings, she does wear a head covering. Mm-hmm. And the book starts, and it's half comic. It is actually the comic, tragic, you know, masks, because the interrogation that she goes through, leaving Britain and then coming to the U.S., it lasts nearly 2 hours. Officials want to know her thoughts on Shias, homosexuals, the Queen, democracy, the Great British Bake Off, the invasion of Iraq, Israel, suicide bombers, and dating websites. Mm-hmm. And she had prepared for this. Is this something you're familiar with? Muslims traveling in the world, training with friends for what they might be asked?
I've never had anything as grueling as Isma's had, but when I go through security, and now I've got a British passport, it's less, but when I had a Pakistani passport, there was always this sort of way in which I was preparing myself. And I did. I mean, I never prepared for questions on the Great British Bake Off, though I know people do get asked things that ridiculous.
They want to detect if you really are a British citizen or if you've somehow faked your papers.
Yeah. It's sort of unclear what it is, because people do. I mean, you know, there are British Muslims who quite clearly have the passport, and it's almost as if they're trying to trip you up somehow, get you agitated. It's completely unclear to me what the questioning is about.
Well, listen, if somebody asked me about the Great British Bake Off.
Yeah.
I don't think I've only watched it once or twice.
So, well, I did. I mean, the last time I came, I thought, what if someone pulls me aside in the American interrogation room and say, so what do you think of our president? You know, you do have these questions. You think, what'll I say then?
Well, and as you write, Muslims prepare. They did try to come up with the right answer. Mm-hmm. And when Isma finally gets to school, we meet another character, Eamon, who is the son of a British official. Tell us more about him and what he means in the story.
He's British like her. His father is from a Pakistani background like her, but they couldn't be more different. His father is a very powerful politician. He's the Home Secretary, which would put him as one of the senior most figures in government. And his father's from a Muslim background, but has really, in some ways, made a political choice to disown the Muslim side of him in order to progress politically. And so Eamon, the son, whose mother is Irish-American, he sort of grows up without any sense of himself as being of a Pakistani or Muslim background. He's just a very privileged British boy who's used to every kind of privilege and doesn't think about this aspect of his own heritage. And then he runs into Isma.
Well, Isma and her siblings do have to think about it, because another part of the backstory is that the father that they hardly knew was a fighter for Muslim causes, from Bosnia to Chechnya to perhaps Guantanamo. I mean, there's a backstory that they don't know that much about. And that brings us to Parvez, the brother who, when the sisters fly off, he is preyed upon by ISIS. He's recruited. And part of it is he desperately wants to know who this father was. I mean, there are so many threads here. Do you know these people? Were you imagining these people? What would it be like if your father was at Guantanamo? Where did it all come from?
It was a fair amount of imagining and some sort of extrapolating from situations that might be more familiar. But I suppose I've spent a number of years thinking about young British Muslims and what it is for someone a generation younger than me who's really grown up Muslim in the post 9/11 world and who feel themselves within a country always being an object of suspicion. You know, and that's true of those whose fathers didn't have this life. But in this case, I overlaid on it the fact that this particular family, there's an extra level that's internalized because they know that their father really was this terrorist to some, a freedom fighter to another.
And you seem to put those fears in the mouths of a cousin. We've said Parvez does get recruited by ISIS, the brother. And at one point, Anika, his twin, is desperate, just like Antigone, to help her brother. And she appeals to this cousin in Pakistan. And he says, "Crazy girl, I don't want to know anything. Did you stop to think about those of us with passports that look like toilet paper to the rest of the world, who spend our whole lives being so careful we don't give anyone a reason to reject our visa applications? Don't stand next to this guy. Don't follow that guy on Twitter. Don't download that Noam Chomsky book." And then he goes on to say, here's what your brother did. By joining ISIS, he jeopardized everyone that ever knew him.
Yeah, it's the whole guilt by association thing, right? I mean, if you're a Muslim and some cousin or relative of yours or someone with the same last name has done something, you have to live with that. You know, if you're a Muslim committing a crime in the world, you're never the lone wolf. Everyone in any kind of contact with you is viewed with suspicion. And the cousin that is talking at this point isn't just Muslim, but he's Pakistani. He's got a Pakistani passport. He has to go through incredibly rigorous visa checks to come to America, where his sister lives. And he's saying, you know, this distant cousin who I never knew has gone and done something, and now that jeopardized my ability and my parents' ability to go to the country where my sister, their daughter, lives.
So many characters, so many story threads that all come, you know, knit together. But we want to mention, you know, this is modern day. In Sophocles' time, in Greek mythology, there was the Greek chorus, you know, the people watching on the sidelines, maybe giving some insight, describing events or narrating or talking to the characters. You have media and social media.
Yeah, I had some fun with that because you know, when I was reading the play, of course, the Greek chorus plays a huge part. And one of the things you notice is they're quite fickle. And one moment they're siding with the king, and the other moment they're saying, oh, but Antigone is looking so sad, and, you know, I'm sort of feeling for her right now. And as I was reading it, I thought, oh, this could be Twitter, you know. And I wanted to work in that sense of the wider world. So although it is about two families, it's also about the country they're in and the mood of the country. And I wanted to get that through via the tabloid press, via Twitter, via news reports and all kinds of things. And you know, because that is the chorus. Yeah. With which we're living in.
Antigone does not end well for Antigone.
No. That's the nature of Greek tragedy.
And yeah, I was glad that I didn't go remind myself that. And I would say to listeners, read your book first and then go back to Antigone. But your ending is just stunning. We don't want to give it away, but it is breathtaking, breathtakingly sad. Why end it on that note? Because you could have just jiggered it a little. I mean, it's Antigone, so you kind of, but you could have just jiggered it a little bit.
So here's the thing. When you write a novel, you come to get very deeply invested in the lives of your characters.
Same when you read it. Yeah.
I'm telling you, it's more if you're living with them for months and months. And so as I'm approaching the ending, I lie to myself about what that ending is because I can't bear what the ending actually is. So I tell myself that I am going to actually fudge it in a little way or make something else happen. But there's a sort of inexorable logic to the novel you're writing. It's moving in a certain direction. And at a certain point, there is only one endpoint that makes sense. I like to believe that even within the ending there is something that is human in a way that is optimistic. But to give but really it's going to be all right, folks, ending is just false, you know. And there are too many moments that we're living in and around us where we know that it's a lie to say that. And what we have to say is, look, this is the direction in which we're heading. Look at it. Just look at it. And then go away and think about that and see what you want to do about it.
Kamala Shamsi, the novel is Home Fire, a novel. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Today, there's news that one of the world's biggest energy companies could soon get bigger. French oil giant Total plans to purchase the oil and gas division of the Danish company Maersk for nearly $5 billion. This comes as the industry is starting to regain its footing after years of low oil prices. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He's also co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Robin, good to talk to you.
So Maersk is better known as a logistics and transportation company. What does this deal mean?
Right. Most people will know if you live anywhere near a port or drive by one, you'd see Maersk containers. They also have an oil and gas portion. It's a conglomerate. And I would say this is akin to buying up real estate after a big crash. Oil prices are a half of where they were a couple of years ago. And once it all settled down, once oil prices dropped, oil companies had to find a way to save money. So what you've got now is oil companies that can make money with oil at a much lower price. And as oil prices start to increase, they've got extra cash flow and they're prepared to buy other oil companies or buy, in this case, the oil and gas portion of a company that sort of doesn't want to be in the oil and gas business anymore.
Well, so what does this mean? Talk about the bigger international picture. We know that Total, again, it's spelled Total, but it's
pronounced
Total.
That's right, but it's pronounced Total, yeah.
Yep. Just announced a big natural gas project this summer with Iran.
Yes.
What are the risks there?
Well, there's always the risk in Iran when you, follow the news that the administration will decide that it doesn't like this deal. I would say that horse has left the barn because the world and including Europeans have been much more interested in doing deals in Iran, which has a lot of oil and for 40 years has not been able to develop its oil industry. So it's not the first such example we've seen in Iran, but fundamentally, people expect the price of oil to increase from the $50 a barrel it's at now, maybe not to $100 a barrel, but sort of closer into the 60s and 70s. And once you're into $60, oil is profitable. So what these companies with money like Total are looking to do is increase their capacity to produce oil. And if they buy other players at a discount, as they are now, what they'll do is, as oil prices go up, be able to make more money.
Okay, so I've waited, 3 minutes. I think that's polite, before asking the question that most people care about, which is, what does this mean for us when we buy gas?
Well, ultimately, the ownership of the oil companies and the producers don't mean much for people who buy gas at the end of the day. The price of oil, the underlying price of oil, which has much more to do with geopolitics, does. Oil got down to, it was very low, but in 2016, about a year ago, we were still looking at oil with a three in front of it. Oil got to about $50 a barrel by the end of 2016. It's hanging around between $40 and $50 now, 40 $45 and $50. And it's not clear. The upward trajectory of oil seems to have pulled back a little bit. Most experts think oil is going to be up around $60, which means gas prices will go up a bit from where they are now.
Okay, I'm going to do something very unfair. You just got a couple seconds here. The CEO of Chevron is stepping down, according to the Wall Street Journal. Just a one line on that.
Yeah, literally, they are, you know, it's a new world. They are looking for new leadership at Chevron. This was relatively well expected.
Okay. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor, economics correspondent, also co-host of Velshi and Rule. Thank you.
My pleasure.
A new TV series on the Discovery Channel shows how the FBI used the Unabomber's own words to track him down. The drama follows the manhunt for Ted Kaczynski, whose crimes span from 1978 to 1995.
For 17 years, he's been planting and mailing bombs. 16 bombs, 3 people killed, dozens injured. And we really have no friggin' clue who he is or why he's doing this. And we call him the Unabomber because his early targets were universities and airlines. UN for university, A for airline, Unabomb.
Manhunt Unabomber stars actor Sam Worthington as James R. Fitzgerald, the FBI profiler who helped crack the Unabomber case. And James Fitzgerald joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, Magna. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. Now, you're a consulting producer on this show, and you did see the scripts beforehand, but you've been actually watching the final product along with the rest of us for the first time as the episodes aired. So what do you think of it so far?
Oh, without a doubt, I'm very impressed with the production value, the acting, and the writing. A few surprises in there for me, a few changes from the scripts that I read. But on the whole, I think it's telling a very interesting story of a very interesting case and a set of characters involved, you know, specifically the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski. So I think that a lot of the public's learning for the first time what this guy was all about and what made him tick, at least a little bit, and they certainly will by the end of the series.
So tell us, I mean, you were involved with the case for quite a period of time. For people who don't know, what was your involvement?
I came in July of 95. The investigation had already gone on 17 years. There was a Unabomb Task Force, UTF for short, and I was a seasoned FBI agent, 7 years in New York City. But as a brand new profiler, after 12 weeks of training at Quantico, I was asked, which in the FBI kind of means you're being told, if I would go to San Francisco and work on this case for 30 days. Well, a year and a half later, I was still there, went back and forth a little bit, but we eventually did solve the case as a team, and I was glad to be a big part of it.
So let's talk a little bit about the criminal profiling part, right? Because I think that's one of those things that in the mass media, you know, it's so often used in dramas, like there's a federal criminal profiler and they're going to crack the case. I mean, does it really work that way? I mean, how does it work in a case like Ted Kaczynski?
I've said this before, but it's basically you're taking all the possible suspects in the country, pouring them into sort of a metaphorical funnel, and out at the very bottom should come a very basic set of demographic and personal attributes or traits. It's never a name or an address, but hopefully it's something that can they can at least narrow the suspect pool and focus on certain kinds of people. And when I came in, there were already about 5 different profiles written. Then it was my job to get involved more in that. But then I also sort of morphed into my earliest days of being a forensic linguist. And I wasn't even familiar with that term back then, but that's actually what I wound up doing.
Well, so I want to ask you about that. So when we say forensic linguistics, what does that mean? And how did you use that in the Unabomber case?
Well, I didn't use that term back then. They're using it a little bit in the series. It's one of the few things where they go a little bit off kilter in terms of what really happened or what language was used there. But in terms of the language analysis components of the series, what the viewers are seeing, it's pretty much right on. I picked up a few things that nobody had noticed before in some of the letters, including the 1985 letter to a Dr. McConnell at the University of Michigan. It was a ruse letter to open up a device, you know, and which it did in fact explode. Down the left-hand column was certain letters, and the beginning of each paragraph spelled out the words, "Dad, it is I."
Was it a message that Kaczynski had encoded into the letter?
Well, we found other codes in the manifesto as well as in letters that he wrote. Not so much columnar, you know, vertical coding like this, but sort of contraindicators designed to point the investigation away from who he really was. And the Unabomber was a wordsmith. He made virtually no mistakes in his 35,000-word manifesto, which he never called it a manifesto, by the way. He referred to it as an article.
So we should talk about the manifesto a little bit more, because I think for those people who do remember this case, that was one of the defining features of it, which I believe he demanded be published in the New York Times, right?
Yes, he offered a bargain to the New York Times, and the Washington Post was also allowed to publish it.
Yeah.
If, in fact, you do publish this in whole, in its entirety, in so many words, I will cease and desist from bombing for purposes of killing people in the future. I argued this guy, he seemed to be serious about wanting to maintain his reputation, not just some lonely nut. And that if he's going to make an offer like this, it's probably something we should take him to for his word on, because it may save lives. But equally as important, someone is going to recognize this guy's distinctive, idiosyncratic, almost unique in some way, writing style that he was utilizing in this manifesto and his earlier letters. It took a few months, but finally we got that phone call, and the case started building from there.
It was the phone call from his brother?
It was, and actually his brother's attorney, and it took a few months to do this. And but just like I've told, seasoned investigators over the years have come up to me, well, the brother turned him in, so that made the job easy, right? I said, seriously, have you ever worked a homicide or serial rape or even bank robbery case, and someone calls and said, hey, Joe Smith on Fifth Avenue is the one that did the – you can't just go out and arrest somebody. You need to build your case.
So we've got a clip from the first episode that sort of has to do with the manifesto. And in it, you'll hear Sam Worthington, who plays you, speaking to a colleague, and you're talking about the manifesto and the need to throw out everything investigators thought they knew about it and just start over. So let's listen.
When he talks down on people with advanced degrees, is he actually low IQ with no higher education, or is he really smart, maybe has a bunch of degrees and knows we're going to read this letter and is hoping that we don't think too hard about it?
Wow. Yeah. I don't know.
Exactly. We don't know.
You know, it's been, what, 21 years plus? I mean, looking back at the case and the way that you had to work it, I'm wondering, how has it stayed with you? Did it change you in your approach to law enforcement and investigations?
It really did. I never called myself a linguist, but I am a forensic linguist now. And really the techniques that I first utilized, at least in my career, and only a few other folks out there were even looking into it back in the mid-90s. But nowadays it's a recognized subscience of or subfield of linguistics. And it's now I've testified at least a dozen times in U.S. courts, opinions I have about different cases. And there's some bad guys in prison, in part because of my testimony and other testimonies. Another evidence, of course, which pointed towards them.
Yeah. So, cases like this are so complex. They're so detailed. There's so many people involved that it's impossible to distill all of that down into a dramatization, right? So is there anything that the series doesn't quite get right?
Well, that's a very good question, Meghna. And there were 100 agents at any time that were and support personnel, analysts who were working this case. There was a lot of false leads followed, a lot of red herrings. I mean, but we had to go that direction. There's a lot of frustration in cases like this. And I'll be frank with you and your listeners. My character, the Fitz character, is a composite character. He didn't do everything illustrated on the miniseries itself. And as I told other folks, there was no one-on-one interaction with Ted Kaczynski and Fitz. That's come from the imagination of the writers. But I was supposed to interview Kaczynski 10 years after his arrest in 2007, actually 11 years, and I had all these questions written out. I was 30 miles away from his prison when his correctional officer called and canceled the interview on me. And I sort of related that information to these writers and my questions I would have had for him, and they put that whole thing together and made these sort of fictional scenes between the Fitz character and the Kaczynski character. So I think it's well done, and it helps express both people's sort of insecurities and angst and where they wanted the case to go and where they wanted their own lives to go.
So what would you have asked him if really it had been you sitting down across from him?
Well, I would have certainly tried to build rapport with them first and then see where it goes from there. And obviously at some point the goal would be, well, can we go back into your youth and why do you think you did this? Why do you think you did that? Why this victim? Why that victim? And see how it would come out.
Well, James R. Fitzgerald is the former FBI profiler who helped catch the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski. He's one of the focuses of a new miniseries on the Discovery Channel called Manhunt Unabomber. The latest episode airs tonight. Mr. Fitzgerald, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Magna. Take care.
39-year-old cafeteria manager Jason Smith of Grayson, Kentucky, had no formal culinary training, but he had a dream to be a star on the Food Network. Here's his audition video for that show, The Next Food Network Star.
Nobody brings to the table that down-home country feel that wraps you like a blanket and add that little bit of fancy twist. I really have what they've never seen. They need to smear me all over Food Network like peanut butter on a peanut butter jelly sandwich.
Well, last year, Jason won the Food Network's Holiday Baking Championship, but that audition tape won him a coveted spot on The Next Food Network Star, a 10-week competition in which he'd cook live while answering questions coming in on Facebook and Twitter. He'd prepare dishes for themed events like a Beauty and the Beast party and shoot his own pilot under the watchful eye of Food Network celebrity guy Fietti. This month, it all paid off.
The winner of Food Network Star is
Jason!
Yay! And Jason Smith joins us from Lexington, Kentucky. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. Honey, I'm just tickled to death to be on today.
Well, we're tickled to have you. Hey, what are they saying there where you're a cafeteria manager in Grayson, Kentucky?
You know, they are just so thankful. They are just happy to be on the Lord Honey bandwagon. It's just like a little bitty village, and they just love it.
Well, I hope so. Look, you learned how to cook, you understand, growing up on a farm. From who?
From my grandmother, my aunts, my mom. Even my grandfather done a lot of cooking.
Yeah. This did not make you, from what I gather from your audition tape, the most popular kid in town. The kids called you Twinkie. You were a little bit overweight.
Oh, yes. I was a lot overweight, honey. They wasn't a little bit. I was a lot. I was the biggest hog in the bunch, trust me. Well, but now I love to eat, so that was kind of my fault.
How'd you change that, by the way? You're not overweight now.
No, actually, I lost a whole person about 6 years ago. I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, and I just went low carb for a while and lost the weight. I went like from 258 pounds to 139. I lost a whole person.
Yeah. Well, and you get to say now to those schoolyard bullies, oh, yeah, I'm the next Food Network star. But what do you do about, you know, that very important food issue at the center of all this? Because you say, you know, you can't cook without bourbon, bacon, or butter, the holy trinity of Kentucky.
You can still have the good things that you want to eat. You learn to eat a little bit less, but you still can eat all the good stuff.
You describe your point of view as country bling. Mm-hmm. People pay a lot of attention to your wardrobe, those, you know, watermelon shirts, the bedazzled jacket in the finale. One of your fellow contestants referred to you as Liberace.
Yeah.
How much of this is about, as you once said, you're really a very old Southern woman trapped in a body dying to get out. This is about the food, but what else is it about?
You know, it's about a way of life. It's about standing out from my outfits to my cooking. I mean, I've always dressed this way. This has just been a part of me ever since I can remember. And I've always liked to wear bright, colorful clothing, different patterns, you know, and it just makes you stand out in the world. It makes you not blend into everybody else. I want everybody to be their own personality. Don't stand in the corner and just blend in with the crowd. Honey, come out of the corner and become your own personality. You know, believe in yourself. And I do that with my clothing and my food. I take what my style is and the way that my Jasonisms, as most people say them, come out and everything, and I put that in my food. We go around this sun only one time, and we might as well have fun while we're doing it, and that's what I do every day.
Yeah. Jasonisms, give us a couple.
Finer than frog hair, split four ways.
I've never seen that.
Oh, you've never seen it? I'm telling you, it's so fine, honey, you can't see it. That's the whole thing.
Give me another one.
I'm happier than a possum eating a sweet tater pie, because they ain't nothing better than sweet tater pie, and possums are happy creatures because they'll eat anything.
Look, one of our producers, Karen Miller-Metzen, has been following you on Twitter since you won the Holiday Baking Challenge. She says you're really responsive to answering baking questions. She's quite the baker. You're really good on social media, and you really want to talk to people. Do you think that's a part of why you won?
I do have a feeling that that's a little bit a part of why I won, because I pay attention to my fans, my friends, my family. It doesn't matter who sends me a question. I'm going to answer it. I may not answer it right away, but I'm eventually going to get to it. And I feel like that that's just part of me giving back to everybody, that I've got to take them on such a great journey. The least I can do is to help them out in the kitchen on social media. If they have a question, I've had people to say, stuff to me that's not about cooking or about food. It's like, I'm going to this event. Should I wear a red jacket or should I wear a black shirt? And I'm like, well, I need to see what you're trying to put together. And they'll send me pictures. And I'm like, no, girl, this ain't going to work. We got to do something different. So, you know, I just like connecting and staying connected with everybody. And I feel that everybody is family to me, whether it's a fan in Australia or whether it's a fan in my next door town. You know, I just feel like that we're all family, and I just love taking everybody along and helping people.
Jason Smith, best of luck to you.
Thank you, thank you.
Jason Smith, winner of the Next Food Network Star, and we are so happy. By the way, later today on All Things Considered, some food companies say they're fighting climate change by working with farmers to reduce greenhouse gases released from fertilizer, but it doesn't seem to be working. That story later on ATC. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.